The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Neuroscience. This is a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm John Griffiths from CAMH and the University of Toronto, and I'm co-host of this channel with Christopher Harris and Joseph Friedman. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Harris. Chris is a scientist and an educator with the company Backyard Brains, and I'm going to be talking with him today on a variety of fascinating topics, including neurorobotics, computational neuroscience, and STEM education. Chris, hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So, Chris, before we get into the exciting work you've been doing at the moment, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, so I have a perhaps slightly unusual background for a neuroscientist. So I started out in psychology and philosophy. That's my undergraduate degree. And during that degree, I got very interested in the brain and eventually ended up doing a PhD in neuroscience in England at the University of Sussex. And then I moved to the US in 2012 to do a postdoc at the National Institutes of Health. And my PhD studies in neuroscience were used a small sea snail as the model organism. And the advantage of doing that is that you can see and record from neurons in the brain individually. So snails do have a brain, and it contains about 20,000 neurons. And we focused on the part of the brain that controls feeding behavior. And one of the things that you can do with a small system like that is that you can expose it to important neurotransmitters like dopamine and observe exactly how a small network like this responds to dopamine. Dopamine is the chemical in the brain that controls motivation and learning, attention, that sort of thing. And that's been my main interest in neuroscience ever since. When I came to the National Institutes of Health, I was studying the zebrafish. So a little bit of a step up, but not that far. A larval zebrafish, which is what we studied, has about 80,000 neurons. And in the zebrafish, we studied vision primarily. I tried to get into the dopamine story with the zebrafish, but it's difficult when they're so young. But yeah, that's my training as a neuroscientist.
And zebrafish, when you're studying them, they're larval, right? So they're small, transparent old. Kind of pieces of jelly, pretty much.
That's right. They're only a week old, and the advantage is that when they're so young, their skin is transparent and their skull is transparent, and so you can actually do calcium imaging, which is a very powerful method for studying individual neurons. You can do that with these zebrafish without actually having to open up the brain and interfere with the animal. You can restrain it in a little gel and even leave its eyes and its tail free to move. And then you can put them under a two-photon microscope and you can see thousands of cells sometimes individually and record from them. And you can, crucially, you can expose the fish to visual stimuli and other stimuli to actually see how the brain processes visual information and transforms it into motions of the eyes and the tail.
And what is the difference as, say, from the point of view of a neurobiologist and maybe as a data analyst between going from a snail with, I guess, a couple of dozen electrode recordings maybe, and then calcium imaging in a fish where you must have hundreds or thousands of data points per millisecond?
Right.
I guess that's a big shift.
It's a big shift. And I ended up doing quite a bit of, you know, a lot of neuroscience is trying to interpret your data. You can record a lot of data, and then the question is how can we make sense of it, and how can we make it do something useful? And yes, with calcium imaging, you get hundreds and hundreds of cells, and the big challenge is to cluster them into groups that you believe are actually present. And then with the zebrafish, the promise is that because the brain is relatively small, we can do something called electron microscopy or 3D electron microscopy to reconstruct the specific synapse configuration, the specific connections between the neurons in this small brain. And by doing that, we can really get to the bottom of what the circuits in the brain really are and how they produce this activity that we're observing. This is not something that we've done yet. We haven't been able to create this kind of detailed map of the connections within the zebrafish brain yet, but it's within reach. So it's something that we're hoping to do within the next 5-10 years.
Excellent. And so from the human mind and psychology to snails to fish, and then onto cognitive neurorobotics. So I think it's going to be fair to say that the background there in terms of the model organisms is going to come back through this conversation a few times in terms of trying to understand simple brains.
Right.
But why don't you tell us now about that transition? So now you're in the area of neurorobotics and educational neurorobotics. So how do you go from your work in the fish and your kind of neuroscience research to this latest evolution in your career trajectory?
Right. So towards the end of my postdoc at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, I sort of realized that I didn't quite have the right temperament for basic science. Doing science in a lab, especially at a place like the NIH, it requires you to be very to have a attention for detail, a love for precision, a focus on making small but consistent incremental steps forward. You have to be patient. You have to accept that change is slow. You have to specialize, and focus on one system, one particular setup, one behavior for years and years and years. And it's never about the thing that maybe drives you into neuroscience to begin with, which is the amazing brain and what it's able to do and the fascination that you get from just thinking about the brain, the human brain, the many things it can do and how it does it. When you're actually in the lab studying your particular little snail or fish year in and year out, it's a very different situation. And for me, I didn't feel like I would be able to perform as well as you need to be able to attract funding as a scientist if I continued down that route. During my time at the NIH, I had gotten interested in neurorobotics, the idea of using simulated brains to control robots. And I had played around with writing software to implement computational models of neurons. And I'd kind of discovered online shopping in the US and realized that I could get all the parts that I needed for a small robot sent to my door in 2 days for, you know, less than a few hundred dollars. And so I was kind of playing around with the idea of building brain-based robots, but I didn't get any uptake within the NIH. There was my PI, my boss was not interested. And neurorobotics has a slightly bad name within neuroscience. It's getting better, but basically people feel that you have too many free parameters with these robots, and that what you're basically doing is you're spending a lot of money building robots that can replicate experimental data, but cannot necessarily produce new testable hypotheses. This is changing a little bit now because computer power is increasing and because models of brains and circuits are getting better. But it's still the case that neurorobotics is not at the forefront of neuroscience, certainly. Brain modeling is a little bit different, but neurorobotics actually claiming to have a brain controlling a robot or a brain-like system controlling a robot and kind of deriving scientific value from that, that's still slightly out of reach, or at least controversial.
What is the adage? It's first they tell you you're crazy, then they tell you you're stupid, then they tell you they knew it all along. Right? somewhere on that arc, maybe.
Right. So I had this idea that I had this interest in brain-based robots, basically. And what attracted me to it was that it was more practical, and I could see that it was something that I could, where I could make a significant difference quickly. I could see that there is nothing in principle stopping us from developing really advanced brain models and having them do fascinating, interesting stuff in robots. The computational neuroscience is the limiting factor there. And so I was attracted to the idea of working with robots like that, but I didn't want to do it in a normal science context where I would be spending another 5 years trying to model a particular visual-motor response of a particular fish in extreme detail. That was not what I wanted. So I got interested in the idea of using these robots for education, because within education, I felt like it was an opportunity to highlight that the brain is fascinating, that neuroscience is fascinating, that it is inspiring, that it's something that will engage students even with very little science background. Most students are interested in the mind and interested in psychological processes. And so I found this grant that the National Institute of Health awards, which is called a Small Business Innovation Research Grant, an SBIR grant. And I reached out to a company called Backyard Brains, who I work for now. And they had in the past attracted these kinds of grants to develop high school neuroscience research equipment. So they had focused on something called a spiker box, which is a cheap electrophysiology rig. Cheap and affordable and user-friendly electrophysiology rig that allowed students to record EEG from the head, or record spikes from nerves of cockroaches or earthworms, and to stimulate the nerves of the hand to kind of cause involuntary contractions and those kinds of simple but very instructive experiments, and making them available to students in the classroom. And so I contacted them and proposed that we should write a grant together to develop these neural robots. And it sort of took off from there. I joined the company. We applied for this grant three times before we had success. But on the third trial, we got the award, and it's a pretty significant award that will keep us going for many years, hopefully. And basically, our mission is to make neural robotics available to high school students around the world, and hopefully beyond high school. We were basically interested in making the brain more accessible to everyone using neural robots, using simulated brains, visualizations of brains, user interfaces where you can easily do things like add testosterone to a brain or add dopamine to a brain and observe the responses.
Great. That's fantastic. That's really brings us up to the present day and to the meat of the conversation. So let's get down to business now and talk about the innards of the neuro robot infrastructure that you've been developing. Then you had an excellent paper published very recently in Frontiers in Neuro Robotics just last month, that is February 2020. And the paper was titled Neuro Robotics Workshop for High School Students Promotes Competence and Confidence in Computational Neuroscience. Now, for listeners, this was in a journal called Frontiers. Frontiers is an open access journal, so anyone can view and download a PDF of this article. You just need to find it. So if you just Google Christopher Harris, Frontiers in Neuro Robotics, you should get the URL from probably the top hit. And so the article itself, it spells out these main components of your project. It has all of this info, the rationale, the hardware and software design specs, which are fascinating, the details of these high school educational workshops you've been running. And I'd really like to go through each of these in turn and kind of unpick and hear about all the work and the ideas and the innovation you've been putting in those areas. So we had a bit of the background in terms of your motivations just now, but maybe we could flesh out, or you could flesh out for us, the rationale a little bit more. So why go for this, you know, slightly on the face of it, slightly eclectic mix of robotics, computational neuroscience, and high school education? What's the reason for putting those things into the pot?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, the kind of the overarching significance of the project, or the purpose of the project, is to remedy the fact that high school students generally, at least in the US, don't get any education in neuroscience. There is usually a small neuroscience component to biology and or psychology classes, but they're small. They're not individual units. And this is a problem because neuroscience is critical, but 1 in 5 people will suffer some sort of mental disorder or disability in their lifetime. And currently there are very few cures or even effective treatments for most brain disorders. So we have an impulse, we have a need to educate the workforce of the future in neuroscience. But beyond that, like I said, neuroscience itself is just fascinating. It's really interesting. It's what we are. It's unique in the sciences, I think, in terms of how it speaks directly to us as human beings. And it's increasing quickly. We are learning more and more every year about the brain. And this is reflected in high student interest. So when we go and speak to schools, we usually find that the students are asking for neuroscience classes, and that the teachers are very eager to be able to offer them neuroscience classes. The problem has been that there's so little in the way of both curriculum and kind of hands-on experiments. So it's very important in education to give students the ability to actually work with the things they're learning, so that you're not just telling them about, you know, the contents of brains, but that they actually have an opportunity to work with brains. And that's difficult. The brain is very protected in all animals and hard to reach. And so apart from the electrophysiology experiments that backyard brains had already developed, and perhaps the, you know, the occasional cutting up a squid brain or something like that, there weren't really any exercises for students to do. And so by going for neural robots and making the system one that students could access easily, you know, you make it accessible. It's a drag and drop user interface where you can add neurons and synapses individually or in groups and kind of modify the properties of the brain on a global scale. This gives the students an opportunity to actually work with the brain. And all education research shows that that's really, really important, both for engagement and for confidence, but also for just learning core concepts. And so, great. Yeah, that's the motivation. The only last thing I'd say is that there is an overlap, a kind of growing overlap between neuroscience and artificial intelligence and machine learning. Both use neural networks. They are different neural networks, but both use neural networks. And when you're working with robots, you have an opportunity to use AI networks or machine learning networks to do things like object detection, speech recognition, those kinds of things. And so we include AI as quite a big component, or machine learning as quite a big component of our neuroscience course. And so this means, and this is also something that students are very interested in. They are all, you know, of course, very immersed and embedded in modern technology. And so they are aware of AI, and they like to learn about it. And they understand the idea that brains and AIs have some similarities and also some differences. And this is something we talk about. So in addition to learning what is essentially biology, the students do learn some computer science and data science as well, which is useful.
Excellent. Okay. Well, so now let's get to the real nuts and bolts, and let's talk about the design. So what is this thing? What have we got? What is the neuro robot? Let's start with hardware, mm-hmm. and then we'll think about software and the brain simulation component.
Mm-hmm. So the hardware that we describe in the paper is a DIY design. So meaning all the components that are described in the paper are components that you can buy today online for less than $170. We also have a manufactured robot where we have actually, you know, designed and printed the circuit board itself. And this allows us a bit more freedom in terms of, you know, functionality and price and usability and customization and that kind of thing. But basically, the DIY robot described in the paper is the same as the manufactured robots that we use in the classrooms. They're functionally the same. So what you have is you have a camera, you have a microphone and a speaker, you have a distance sensor, and you have two wheels and a swivel wheel at the back, but basically two wheels and a big battery pack. And that's sort of it. And then the robot communicates with a laptop via Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. And it basically implements information flow where you have the simulated brain on the laptop generating motor output that's communicated to the speaker and to the motors of the robot. So it moves around and makes sounds in the environment, in the classroom. And then its camera and microphone are picking up, and distance sensor are picking up sensory information. And that sensory information is then sent back as feedback to the brain, which affects how the brain is processing and then, you know, changes the output. And so it goes around and around and around like that. So you've implemented kind of a sensory motor loop using a robot that's not, it doesn't have any arms, any effectors, anything like that. We're not trying to make it look like a human. It's what we wanted was to have the visual information, the motor output, the sensory, the speaker input and voice or sound output. And that's kind of it, because seeing and hearing are our two most kind of powerful senses. Movement is I think essential for kind of engaging students. And then by adding sound output, you can in principle imagine communicating with this robot. And that's what, right, I was interested in. I didn't really want to get into, you know, the mechanics of walking, or the mechanics of trying to grip an egg, or of crawling or anything like that, which is what a lot of neurorobotics is kind of focused on. At least that's
indeed. So that was maybe a strategic decision on your part to skip, as you said, one of the principal topics in robotics in general, which is motor articulation with joint type, you know, hands and arms and so on.
Yeah.
You have something that's kind of like a little, you know, toy car. But you're interested in essentially the slightly higher cognitive aspects of organisms and nervous systems that is just one step abstracted away from the specific articulations of, let's say, like mammalian legs and arms, and also the specific way that sound and visual information is parsed through the retina and maybe the earlier visual system.
Absolutely.
Maybe you start just one step above those two.
That's right. I did not want to get stuck in something that would take a long time to build. Like, there's a lot of people working on how the brain responds to the whiskers of a rat, for instance, being touched, and they spend years and years trying to get that exactly right. And to me, I just didn't want to get stuck in something that wouldn't be of maximal interest to students, basically. And it's fine. I'm glad that people are working on robots that could, in principle, walk or have facial expressions or, you know, do the dishes or something like that. That's going to be very useful in the future. But it didn't feel like the place where I could really contribute. What I wanted to do was to create something that was as cheap as possible, with a potential for being something like a companion or almost like a pet that you could interact with without a lot of expensive hardware.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Okay. So you have the virtual robot device, and then the control is being done by either a laptop-based brain simulation or a mobile phone-based brain simulation. So, do you want to go into the details of maybe the kind of the implementation type things first, and then we'll switch over to the neurobiology or your take on the neurobiology?
Sure. So, let me speak about the laptop app. First, we are working on an iOS app, but it's not at all ready, and it wasn't part of this paper. But the laptop app is written in MATLAB. I'm a scientist, and many scientists use MATLAB just because that's how we get indoctrinated early on, and I've just kind of stuck with it. And so the app itself is written mainly in MATLAB, but I eventually ran into some limitations of MATLAB and had to hire an engineer who's written a whole C++ wrapper for the Wi-Fi communication part of the code. But basically, it's a big MATLAB app. It has three modes or two modes. It has two modes, really. There's a runtime mode where you can see what the robot is seeing. So you're seeing the video stream displayed in real time, and you're seeing a spectrum that represents the audio input, and then you can see the brain that's being simulated. And that's running in real time, updating about 10 times per second. And then you can pause that at any moment and go into another mode called the design mode, where you can add or remove neurons, add synapses, add groups of neurons using algorithms, and also connect these neurons to the speakers and the motors of the robot.
Right. Right. Excellent. Excellent. So now maybe let's talk about the brain, which is really this, the core motivation and the core on the educational side. This is really where your emphasis is. Mm-hmm. So how did you address this problem? You're trying in the classroom, you're trying to introduce a pretty ambitious set of neuroscience concepts, including neuron types and spiking patterns and sensation, perception, action, plasticity, dopamine, basal ganglia function. So you come up with an architecture to be able to both control the robot device using some of these principles, but also do it in a somewhat transparent enough way to fit into your like classroom educational objectives.
That's right.
So tell us about the how you've gone about this, what the implementation version is in terms of the neuron models, and then what were your primary considerations in deciding how to build this thing, and what would be the best version of a simulated brain to have in this context.
Mm-hmm. So I picked a neuron type called the Ishikevich neuron. So Eugene Ishikevich made a discovery or developed a computational model of neurons, of spiking neurons, back in 2005, sometime around there, which is a good, it makes a very useful compromise between relatively complicated spiking patterns and realistic looking membrane potentials, while at the same time being relatively computationally light. So if you want to do a really intricate neuron model, you should use something called Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, which contains all of the different kinds of currents and other properties of the neuronal membrane that you would need if you were going to do a multi-compartment, detailed, nice neuron model. I didn't think that we would need that to start with. I reckoned that at the beginning we would be using point neurons, so individual neurons that connect with one synapse to any other neuron. And for that, the Ishikevich neuron seemed like a good compromise, because from my work with snails and fish, I knew that to do interesting things with a relatively small number of neurons, you need fairly complicated neurons. They need to be able to do things like generate bursts spontaneously, to respond in different ways to input. So for instance, if you have we have neurons that respond with bursts to input or respond with a single spike to input. And that's important if you want to be able to, for instance, drive a robot forward if it sees something very briefly. If you want that, you can have a neuron that's responding to the visual input and then activates a bursting neuron. And so that will give enough force to kind of drive the robot forward for some time. And that's important. You need things like post-inhibitory rebound. But yeah, I also didn't want to get too complicated. So Ishikevich neurons seemed like a good idea. And then we have two types of plasticity, really one type of plasticity. So we've implemented a sort of spike timing dependent plasticity learning rule, meaning if two neurons are firing at the same time, an excitatory synapse connecting the two will get stronger. In a real brain, the time scale would be very small, so that, you know, the spikes, the action potentials needed would need to happen, you know, within the same 10 milliseconds to have an effect. In our system, we've extended that window, so the spikes need to happen only within the same second, say. And so this is an example of a point where we've relaxed the biological realism of the system in order to make an educational point. And that was important to me, that the point here is not first and foremost to model the brain super accurately. The main point is to be able to get an educational message across to students. And in this case, the main message is that neurons that fire together wire together. The time scale on which that happens is of secondary importance. It's important. And I point out to students where the model differs from what you would expect in a real brain. But the main thing is that you're able to get across a message to students. And so, for instance, one other thing that we've implemented is so my interest, as I said before, is in dopamine and the basal ganglia and kind of action selection and control. And so one way to implement that in a simulated brain like this would be to actually go ahead and build a basal ganglia with neurons, which is something that has been done. Peter Redgrave and many others have attempted to build computational models of the basal ganglia, and then they work, and it's interesting, but they are very complicated and hard to edit. And so, again, what we did was, instead of implementing a proper neuronal model of the basal ganglia, we've implemented an algorithmic model where you can assign neurons in the brain to a unique network, a unique basal ganglia network, a unique network that's under the control of a channel within the basal ganglia. And this means that you can have different networks within the brain being active at different times. So you may have one network that approaches red things. You could have another network that's generating a little dance and a song. You can have a third network that's hiding or makes the robot move to a quiet, dark place, that sort of thing. And so now you have three different behaviors that are incompatible. You cannot have a dancing and a hiding behavior going at the same time. But if you assign these three different circuits, these three different behaviors to different basal ganglia networks, then they will only be able to be activated one at a time. And you can also assign special input to these networks so that one network can be activated during a certain sensory context. And they compete with each other, and they respond to dopamine by being kind of the dopamine basically reinforces the currently selected behavior. And so the point with this is that this selection process, this basal ganglia type dynamics, is implemented algorithmically. It's just an addition to the Ishikiewicz model that I've added, not in the form of a neural network, but algorithmically. One day, I hope we can move away from that and actually have a real basal ganglia in there, compute power permitting. But again, from the time being, the main thing is to be able to get a message across to students that's true, but that can be simplified if necessary.
So what would an example, you mentioned a few briefly just now, dancing and hiding in a corner. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? So what would be the on the ground behaviors that we're talking about here, and then what is the mechanism or the process that you're using and getting the students to use to choose what to reinforce and how, mm-hmm. in what kind of sequence?
So in the first lessons, the students design brains from scratch, meaning they start with a completely empty brain, and I might tell them something like, okay, let's design a brain that moves forward when it sees something red. And so they would just drop a neuron into the brain and then connect the input from the eyes to that neuron and select from a list of possible visual things that neuron can be responsive to. They would select red. And then from that neuron, they would also extend axons to the motors that would drive the robot forward when that neuron is activated. And so now if you put something red in front of the robot, it's going to move forward. Now, if you have, instead of just one neuron, you use two neurons, one that's activating the motors on the left side when something red appears in the right visual field, and another one that activates the left motors when something appears in the right side of the visual field. Now you have something called a Breitenberg vehicle, which will move towards something red, even if that red thing is moving. So basically, if the red thing that you're seeing is on the left and that activates the motors on the right side, that's going to turn the robot towards the red thing. And then the red thing will be in the center of the visual field, activating the motors both on the left and the right side. And so now it's going to move forward. And so now you have something that's approaching something else, which is interesting. Now, maybe you add a third neuron that's connected to the distance sensor and makes the robot move backwards when it's getting too close to something. And so now you have a robot that will move around on the floor, approach red things, but without crashing into objects. And so, and then maybe you add a fourth neuron that produces spontaneous little bursts so that the robot is moving spontaneously. So it doesn't just sit still until it sees something red, but it moves spontaneously. So that's the kind of brain that the students might design in the first two lessons. So yeah, I go pretty simple four neuron brain. And then in the following lessons, I have pre-configured brains that are a little bit more complicated and kind of tuned and balanced so that they will produce interesting types of behavior. Things like dancing, things like responding to audio input with a specific motor output or audio output. If you have two robots in the same place, we can train a neural network so that they can detect each other. And you can use the sound, the microphone and the speakers to have the robots actually communicate with each other. So if they hear a particular tone, they produce a specific response. We're working now on something called RatSlam, which is basically a method for implementing place cells. So hippocampal place cells allow the brain to know where it is in a room. And so you can tie specific locations in a room to specific behaviors this way, so that when the robot gets to a place that's calm or quiet or dark or something, you can tell it, okay, stay there. Now shut off that other circuit that was causing you to explore. So it's early days, but we're finally at a stage where designing more and more interesting brains is kind of the limiting factor, which is great. That's exactly where I want to be. I want the computational neuroscience to be the bottleneck in this project, not the hardware or the software or the money or getting into schools to teach, but actually to have the neuroscience be the limiting factor, because I feel relatively certain that we'll be able to build just more and more and more interesting behaviors using discoveries in neuroscience.
Fantastic. So this question, I think, does speak to your last point about expanding and having the neuroscience be the limiting factor. The question that I have, or a question that occurs to me when I'm thinking about and, you know, seeing one or two videos of the devices, and you have these little clusters as well. You have what, three or four or five of them running at the same time, little kind of pods. I'd say, quote unquote, animal are we looking at here? I mean, obviously, it's a strange hybrid of machine and you know, animal brain, insofar as it has wheels for a start and a digital camera for an eye. Right. But you know, at the level of the kind of behavioral primitives and the Do you have a sense, like, are you basically, do you have a little fish on wheels here, or do you have a little kind of slightly dumb mouse on wheels, or is it like a nematode worm on wheels? Or?
Right. No, it's a good question. I don't think of it in those terms anymore. But now that you mention it, it's true that the hardware design was not entirely based. Arrived at in a rational way, but in the beginning, the aim of these robots was to model the fish, like I said, and so the larval zebrafish, it only has the ability to kind of navigate in two dimensions in these kind of relatively shallow surfaces. So like the robot, it can move left and right and forward and backward, and then it has vision and hearing. And so it's actually kind of similar to a larval zebrafish in some sense, but I don't think of it as a particular animal anymore. And I enjoy, for instance, having the convolutional neural networks that we use for object detection. They kind of give a certain gravitas to the brain if it's able to detect changes in the environment that are that correspond to specific events, or at least able to detect specific objects like shoes or other robots, or like with the students, I frequently bring in balloons and cups and you can train a system to detect anything, so desks and legs, so you and have chairs a, and so on.
You have is it a pre-trained visual module that is in the form of a convolutional net?
Right. I forget if I'm using, I think I'm still using AlexNet. It's actually a relatively old object detection network, but it's kind of like comes pre-installed in MATLAB, so I don't even do that much training of it. I have trained networks to detect other robots, and to do that, you need to take pictures of other robots. I took 100 pictures the first time, and I was struggling, like, why is this not working? It's not working. And then I just took another 150 pictures, so 250 pictures of robots from different angles, and then suddenly it worked beautifully. It's just an instance of you do need large data sets to train these convolutional neural networks, but with enough data you can train them to detect anything. And we want to do the same thing now with voice, so that you can use voice commands to make the robot do something. So again, I think of these as kind of sensory filters. So you have visual filters that could be something simple like a color, or something complex like an object or an event. And same for audio input. You can, at the moment, I have it set up so that the microphone, or so that neurons can be activated by specific tones. But there's nothing stopping us from making a specific neuron that responds to a specific voice command. And so that takes you, if you think of it in terms of kind of Jennifer Aniston neurons and temporal cortex neurons, where you have very high specificity, this kind of artificial neural network allows us to kind of work as if we had an advanced visual system, you know, all the way from V1 up to temporal cortex, that's able to identify specific objects. And so in that sense, I don't feel like I'm working with a small brain, as it were.
Right. So what I'm thinking now is, maybe if we broaden a little bit beyond just the new robot project you have, which is in itself very kind of expansive in its own way, but thinking about the field of neurorobotics in general, or cognitive neurorobotics, or the intersection of computational neuroscience and robotics, do you have any, you know, feeling about what's going on, what's kind of live and exciting in this field at the moment? And then, are there any particular intersection points, or indeed kind of negative intersection points, things you avoid or want to avoid in terms of what's, you know, big topics at the moment in neurorobotics in general? We talked about action motor control things as well, but could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so to me, the interesting so let's see, it's a little bit like there are two separate realms where you have neurorobotics and neuroscientists and computational neuroscience sticking very close to the brain. So if like, for instance, during the review of this paper, one of the reviewers were saying something like that they were having a hard time understanding how we did the vision because they didn't see a model of the retina in there. And to me, that's fantastic. I do not want a model of the retina in there. That's a 5-year project right there, trying to do that right.
50-year project.
Exactly. It's a very, very complicated thing to get that right. And my impression is that scientists, neuroscientists, are forced a little bit to stick almost too close to the brain data. And then on the other side, we have these remarkable developments in AI and robotics. If you think of something like the Google Home, that's a robot that can hear and produce sound output. It can't move, but it doesn't really need to. But in terms of what's inside, there's very little overlap. Apart from AIs using neurons and synapses, there's very little from the brain actually in artificial neural networks today, I would say. I mean, reinforcement learning is a big, big thing, and that in some sense has come from biology. But there's very little in the way of biologically realistic circuitry in anything going on at Google. And so the interesting thing for me is to kind of try to inhabit that space between slavishly sticking to what's given in the biology and at the same time getting too far away from biology. Like I want to try to embrace the messiness of biological systems, the kind of the spontaneity, which is very important, the fact that biological systems always, even in nematode worms, they always have goals and preferences and preferred states, and they express them all the time. Your Google Home doesn't have a preferred state. It doesn't have anything like a want or a need, and its neurons are not active unless they become activated by input from you. You know, a neural network in an AI or in Google Home will only respond, produce activity, and activate downstream layers if they get input. In a brain, it's very different. The brain's producing a ton of activity all by itself. And so in that sense, I guess they're a little bit more like a Roomba, which at least produces spontaneous behavior. But a Roomba's behavior is very predictable as well. With robots, with brains, you have a huge amount of unpredictability. And you have these kind of really canonical structures. You have a thalamus, you have a cortex, you have a basal ganglia. You do have retinas, but my focus is on the core structures, like cortex, like the basal ganglia, that seem to kind of house the most essential part of the experience and the ability. I don't know if that... Good. Makes sense. I hope that's
That certainly was the kind of thing I was wondering. I have another follow-up, but I realize, or it occurred to me from your comments just now, that we should do a follow-up discussion. It would be another discussion another time on what is going on in the head of a brain simulation or indeed a nematode worm. Mm-hmm. More along a kind of philosophical dimension. Of what kind of mind do you have in a fish, a fly, a worm, and a neuro robot?
Well, let me just say one thing, which is that in the lesson, so the fourth lesson is where I kind of go into AI and machine learning properly in the classroom, and that's usually a very successful lesson because the students are very interested in exactly this question. So if you put it to the students that you know, robots and computers are going to get more and more complicated, more and more capable, and you tell them that it's a completely open question at the moment whether a robot that has something like a brain inside, it's a simulation, but something that has the functional, the components of a real brain. It's a completely open question at the moment whether such a thing would be in any sense conscious. Would it be bad to mistreat a service robot? We don't really know, and there are many arguments. There are many ways you can go with that debate. But basically, the question "Is my robot conscious?" is something that the students are very primed to talk about and to get into a discussion about. They really appreciate that question. I think that's great. They don't have any preconceived really notion of what the true answer is, and they appreciate that it's a complicated question. And the robots, I think, provide a good opportunity to explore that question because the students always anthropomorphize the robots. They will give them names. They will treat them right. There was one case where a robot wasn't working and the student group tried to put the robot up for adoption because they cared for it. and so, but obviously if you're working with a robot that has just two neurons simulated, then there's probably no consciousness in there. But then what if there was 20 neurons or 200 neurons or 2 million neurons? What if they were implemented using neuromorphic hardware? Now you kind of start to really appreciate on a kind of hands-on level almost the problems with trying to determine whether something is conscious or not.
Indeed, indeed. And there was a second question which I had that was on the kind of philosophical line partly, but also I think in an interesting way, there's practical dimensions to this, which is that you're working in a very highly embodied paradigm here. I mean, it's kind of an exquisite case of an embodied agent in a way. Yeah. Whereas in other, I mean, conceivably this whole thing could have been done in virtual reality, for example, right? Yeah. And the design of the software would be kind of the same in terms of the internal, you know, the brain control part. Mm-hmm. So do you, you know, when you're designing this, when you were thinking about it, when you're talking about it with the students, do the pros and cons and the kind of the differences between the kind of messy real world embodied scenario that you're presenting here and that you're working with versus a potential alternative, which would have advantages in terms of once you could get it together, if you could have, you know, a simulation of the environment, then, you know, that would have advantages in terms of scaling and, you know, certain things you could do faster with the learning paradigms and so on. I mean, that really is the cutting edge in terms of AI and machine learning. Mm-hmm. The most interesting things in AI and machine learning are simulated environments or simulated scenarios like the Go AI that is, you know, it's that they gamify the learning scenario, but essentially they simulate the learning scenario and then they can just do that at epic speed and epic scale at an epically fast amount of time and generate an awful lot of training data synthetically to then be able to create an effective learned, you know, behaviors and learning process. Mm-hmm. So that those are the advantages of working in the virtual space. You're not working in the virtual space, you're working in the real world. But what are your thoughts about the, you know, relationship between those two here? Mm-hmm.
So there's a spectrum. And actually, even within the field of what I call educational neurorobotics, so robots, brain-based robots used to teach, there are some people, I forget their name now. It's an NSF-funded project. I can't remember the name right now, but they built actual hardware neurons. So individual neurons that you can physically kind of pick up. They are like little plastic devices with an LED on them that indicates when the neuron is firing. And then you physically connect them to other neurons and kind of make as if you're playing a board game or something. That's kind of on one end of the spectrum. And then the other end would be something like the Human Brain Project's neurorobotics platform, which is fully simulated. Everything is simulated and they have a physics engine and you can upload neural networks and connect them to a simulated robot that will move around in a simulated environment and you can test your systems that way. We picked an intermediate level, and I think it was just intuitive on my part. On the one hand, I wanted to have a robot that could move around in the world and make sound and hear sound in the world. Especially the movement was important to me, and when students engage with the robots, I at least believe that the having something that's with you in the world and moves around and can do real things like crash into another robot or fly off a desk or you know, a wheel can fall off, that kind of thing in the world, it adds to the engagement level of the project, I think. That said, I also wanted to have the option of running really, really big simulations in principle. So you can imagine now running a brain that's maybe running in the cloud, or if you have a really powerful laptop, you could run, you know, millions of neurons that would control this same robot. So it's scalable. It's massively scalable in that sense. And one thing you can do with our system is if you go to the paper, there'll be a link to our GitHub repo where all of the code and the entire app, the entire MATLAB app, is available for free. And you don't need a robot to run it. So you can actually run that app, the whole brain simulator, everything on just a laptop using the laptop's web camera and speaker and microphone to do most of the things that you could do with a real robot, apart from the actual movement, of course. And that allows people to kind of try out brain design and see what the app's capabilities are before they buy a robot. And that's kind of and it's free. And so it's kind of a benefit of having this intermediate position between the two extremes of simulation or hardware.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Chris, this has been a fantastic discussion. I'm going to wrap up now with just one final question, which is, what are the future plans? Where are you hoping to take this work in the future, both in terms of the educational dimension with the reach and I guess the depth and the scope, and indeed the hardware and the computational neuroscience element of the robot simulated brain? Where do you want this to be going in 5, 10 years, 20, 50? Take your pick.
So like I said, I've been studying the brain for a long time now. I love neuroscience. I love reading about different theories of the brain. And I hope that these robots will provide a platform where different theories of brain function can be tested. If you say that you have a theory of how the brain does short-term memory, let's see a model of it. Let's build a robot that can remember things that has happened to it in an interesting way. If you have a theory of how the hippocampus does navigation, let's build a model and let's show that this model is able to navigate using only spiking neurons and in a way that's realistic. I basically want to implement as many different interesting, useful theories of brain function as possible in these robots. I'm hoping that with time, those models will get more sophisticated and our robots will get stronger and more sophisticated, and that we can kind of have a symbiotic relationship with computational neuroscience where we try to implement or translate the best or most interesting new models from computational neuroscience into forms that are useful for students in the classroom. I don't think there should be, you know, when a new theory in neuroscience is first developed, maybe then you need an expensive equipment and a supercomputer to run it. But any decent theory of brain function should be, you should be able to compress it a bit and make it useful for something like a simple robot like these are. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to distribute these robots as widely as possible, including to, you know, people's living rooms and science museums and schools, even primary schools, and to basically have various levels of complexity of brain models. And that's complexity both in terms of the process that you're trying to model, the functions that you're trying to implement, but also the amount of interaction that users can have with those models. So if you want to implement a very complicated model of the cortex, for instance, maybe you don't want the students to be messing with the synaptic weights, but maybe you do want them to be able to adjust the levels of stress hormones or serotonin and see the kind of the real effects, what would happen to a real brain if you did that. And so the long-term aim is to just make brains and brain functions increasingly accessible to as many people as possible.
Superb. So just for the listeners, if people wanted to get in touch with you or wanting to follow up and do some more research and learning about your stuff. Could you give some websites, a Twitter handle, any other info that would be useful for people who are trying to find out more about your work?
Absolutely. So I work with Backyard Brains. So backyardbrains.com is the site for that. We don't have anything about the neuro robot on the site much at the moment because we're only just starting to sell a few developer versions to schools, but we're not actually selling the robots yet. But as I said, you can build them yourselves. My Twitter handle is Chris Harris, @ChrisHarris. I think if you go to github.com/backyardbrains/neurorobots, that's kind of the most official website that the project has. And there's a user guide there. There is links to some pictures, YouTube videos, a few things like that if you want to see more of the project. But you can contact me as well, Christopher@backyardbrains.com. I'm on YouTube as well, Facebook, everywhere.
Well, Chris Harris, thanks very much for the conversation.
All right. Thank you very much. This was great.